Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
Our speaker today is Dr. Andy Seidel, Executive Director of the Center for Christian Leadership at Dallas Seminary. He's a graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point. He served in the U.S. Army in Korea, Vietnam, Germany, and the United States before retiring as a colonel. After earning a THM at Dallas Seminary in 1976, Dr. Seidel served as the senior pastor at Grace Bible Church in College Station, Texas, for 14 years. He left the pastorate there to provide pastoral leadership and leadership training for pastors in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And he also earned a Doctor of Ministry here at DTS. Now, through his work at the Center for Christian Leadership, he continues to provide leadership training and development for seminary students as well as ministry and business leaders. In addition to his work at the Center for Christian Leadership, he continues his ministry in Russia, Eastern Europe, and Central Asia with NTrust, which is formerly known as BEE International. In line with his ministry emphasis, he has written a book entitled Charting a Bold Course, Training Leaders for 21st Century Ministry, published by Moody Publishers. Andy and his wife Gail, who is here with us near the front this morning, have been married for more than 40 years, and she is his chief cheerleader and has journeyed along with him all these years, and we're delighted to have her with us as well. They have two married children, six grandchildren, and I want you to join with me in welcoming Dr. Andy Seidel as our chapel speaker today.
Well, I'm taking my cue from Chaplain Bill this morning. He has mentioned the 60s, and that gives some clue as to age and things like that. But he's reminded me of some significant things. You know, someone once told me that the events that you remember most clearly are the events that had a high level of emotional content. And if that's true, then it's no surprise that I can remember so vividly an event that took place in 1968 in mid-January. I was a company commander in Vietnam. I had 200 men in my company, and we were working with the U.S. Special Forces, establishing base camps along the Cambodian border. We moved into an area that was just about 4 kilometers from the border, and the Special Forces team had 450 national soldiers with them. Some of them were Vietnamese, some were Cambodians, some were Hmongs, were Vietnamese of Chinese background. And we were establishing a base of operations there through which they could watch the infiltration of the North Vietnamese into South Vietnam from Cambodia. There was a lot of fighting to begin with, and it was a very, very difficult time. And when we finally got things settled enough so that we had a perimeter, they had one perimeter, and I had my company perimeter right next to them. So we shared one part of it, and then the rest of it we defended from the enemy outside. And as things went along through those days, it was a difficult time. Of the 200 men I had in my command, 118 of them were casualties in one way or another. But they were good. They were fine young American men. And they did their job. And as things kind of moved along, things quieted down a little bit. And by this time, we had built bunkers. We had sandbag bunkers, and we had some wire around the perimeter, and so there was some security. And so what would happen is when we would go out during the day to whatever we were doing that day, sometimes there were ambushes, sometimes there were firefights, and it was very, very difficult. But I'd come back into the base, come back into that secure area, and I felt secure. These were my guys. I knew them. They knew me. And there was security in that compound. Well, one morning, you know, as often happened, we had people awake all night watching because oftentimes there were attacks toward the end of the night. And so we'd be particularly alert from about 4:30 on. Well, about 6:30, nothing had happened, and so I figured there wasn't going to be an attack that morning. And so I came up out of the bunker, and I stood on kind of a raised bunch of dirt there that had been pushed up by a bulldozer or something. And I was looking over part of the forest where we were going to be working that day when all of a sudden, and I felt the air and the shock of the bullet as it went by my left cheek. I hit the ground. And you know, you have those kinds of experiences where all of a sudden you have these thoughts, immediate thoughts. It must have taken less than a second, but it seemed like this long thought. And the two of them came to my mind right then. The first one was, I ducked too late. And it kind of flowered out, and I realized it wasn't because of my military skill or something like that. I was still alive, and the thought came to me, it's only by God's grace that I'm still alive. And then the second thought kind of bubbled to the surface, and the second one was kind of disorienting. And all of a sudden, I realized that shot came from within our own perimeter. And I jumped up and jumped back down to the bunker, got on the radio, and I called my colleague, who was a captain also, Special Forces A-team leader, and I said, I just got shot at. I use proper radio procedure and all that, but I don't think so. I just got shot at, and I think the shot came from your perimeter. He said, well, I'll check it out. The perimeter, you know, there was kind of trees and woods and stuff like that, so it wasn't very clearly defined. And so I went about the business of that day, and when I came back in about 5 o'clock that afternoon, I went over to his area, to his bunker, and I said, what'd you find out? And he looked at me, he said, what I found out was the local Viet Cong commander put a contract on your life. And I said, what? Sound like the mafia or something. He said, what do you mean? And he said, well, the guy who took the shot got away, but one of the other guys that we knew was a Viet Cong sympathizer. What we found out from him is that the local Viet Cong commander gave an order that the two of us, the two captains in the would be assassinated before they attacked. And the assassin missed. Now, here's the point of that. Every time I used to feel secure when I came back into that compound, I never again felt that secure when I came back into that compound. It wasn't like all the bad guys are out there and all the good guys are in here. There was no security. And every time I saw one of those guys, one of those nationals, I wonder, is he one of the ones? Is he? And a lot of churches are that way. A lot of mission agencies are that way. A lot of parachurch ministries and staffs are that way. You know, one well-used study has reported that 95% of pastors feel conflict, experience conflict in their churches. 38% of pastors have left churches just because of conflict in the church. And 71% of pastors say that when the conflict came, it ultimately ended up about them, either about their style of ministry or about their vision, whatever. In my role at the Center for Christian Leadership, I have opportunity to work with many pastors and many leaders of mission agencies and missions in various parts of the world. And one of the things that has just kind of blown me away is some of the stories of conflict I hear are just absolutely tragic. Now, that was the situation when Paul wrote this impassioned letter to the Galatians. I want to look at this passage in Galatians chapter 5, verses 13 through the end of the chapter, verse 26. And I have to say that in my early Christian experience, when I was involved in this chapter or heard it taught, it was always taught as kind of a vague general thing about this is the measure of spirituality. Because, you know, this is where you have the fruit of the Spirit listed. Oftentimes that was pretty much out of context. But I'd like to look at it this morning in the context of ministry and ministry leadership. Now, at this point, as Paul writes to these believers in the churches in Galatia, the situation has really become toxic. There's a major doctrinal issue that is disrupting these churches. There are some persuasive false teachers called the Judaizers who have come in after Paul was there, and they are teaching that a man cannot be saved unless he is circumcised as required by the Jewish law. Now, frankly, that's an important question. It's an important issue. It's an issue that has absolutely got to be dealt with, but not in such a way and with so much anger and vehemence that the church itself is destroyed. And so that's the danger that they are facing in Galatians chapter 5, verses 13 through 26. But notice in verse 13, "For you were called to freedom, brethren." He's not talking to the false teachers. He's talking to the believers there in the churches in Galatia. He's talking to the Christian community there and to the leaders of that community. And the problem is that this Christian community is self-destructing over this issue. Within the church, the conflict has gotten so great that it's gotten out of hand. In fact, it's so far out of hand that in verse 15, he warns, notice what he says, "If you bite and devour one another, take heed that you are not consumed by one another." They're tearing each other up. It's a picture of wild animals. I wish this was true only in the early church. But the problem is that recurring destructive conflict is a kind of a normal experience. 3 centuries after Paul wrote these words to the Galatian believers, a Roman historian named Marcellinus observed the churches of his day, and he said about them that no wild beasts are so cruel as the Christians in their dealings with each other. And throughout the centuries, the flow of years, things haven't changed very much. Indeed, the same things occur in churches and ministries today. I met an associate pastor who had gone to a smaller church. The pastor had been there for a number of years. There were about 150 people in the church. And he was finally able to hire an assistant pastor. And so this young man came right out of seminary to be the associate pastor in this church. And everything went fine until the people in the church began to really appreciate this young guy. And they would say kind things about him. And they began to... Families would invite him over, he and his wife, for supper and something, and all of a sudden, the now senior pastor didn't like that very much. And he kind of withdrew, and he was unkind to this young man, and the atmosphere of hostility began to spread. And it got to the point that the associate pastor didn't even want to go to church to work. After 2 years, he left. Some of the church growth people have done studies, and they said one of the things that prevents small churches from becoming larger churches is this 200 barrier, and one of the things that prevents them from crossing that is they have to add new staff. And sometimes when they add new staff, the previous pastor, he doesn't want to share the admiration of the congregation or the appreciation or the gifts of the congregation with anybody else. This happened in this case. No, it happens all the time. And when you go out into ministry, my guess is that you will experience that as well. What Paul is saying is first that the Christian community ought to be a place of safety and support, not divisiveness and discord. In verses 13 through 15, that's what he's saying. And in those verses, in this toxic environment, he makes a very, very shocking statement. Notice in verse 13, he says, "Through love, serve one another." Now, he doesn't just use the normal word for serve. He uses the word for slave. And the interesting thing is that it's shocking because he's been emphasizing their freedom. In verse 1 of chapter 5, he said, "It was for freedom that Christ has set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery." In verse 13, at the very beginning, he says, "For you were called to freedom, brethren." And all of a sudden, he says, "Through love, enslave yourselves to someone else." And I think his point was, as they were reading this, all of a sudden they would get to this point. What? It's simply a strong statement about putting others' needs before your own. What would it be like on a church staff if the leader of a men's ministry saw that the youth ministry needed some help, and so he recruited some people from his ministry to go and help the youth pastor in that ministry? What would that be like? What if rather than becoming siloed and competing with each different ministry in the church for the budget funds, ministries worked together and shared together? What if a community pastor who thought the men's pastor was not very spiritual moved toward him, encouraged him, rather than trying to avoid contact with him and saying things behind his back? What would that be? Put very simply, what Paul is saying is get your eyes off yourself and find a way that you can lovingly help those that you serve with. He goes on to say, if you want to argue about the law, consider this. The whole law is fulfilled in one statement. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Paul is saying the believer who acts in love to serve one another is actually fulfilling the law. But you see, as you go on in this passage, the problem is that our tendency to sin and selfishness, self-centered actions, disrupt the community in terrible ways. And so Paul talks here about the flesh, and he uses the term flesh 6 times in this passage. The flesh is the only part of the human experience that is not redeemed. It's that inclination that arises in each one of us to lead us to experiences that are contrary to the will of God. The inclination to sin. And the flesh will attach itself to anything, even good things, to pull us towards sin. Notice how in verse 13 he begins by saying, "You were called to freedom, brethren, but only don't turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another." Even freedom can become an opportunity for the flesh. And the term he uses there, opportunity, is actually a military term. It means a base of operations. Don't let your freedom become a base of operations for your flesh to lead you to sin, particularly is concerned here, the sin that harms your brothers and sisters in Christ. Now, from that base of operations, if it isn't checked, the flesh will produce all kinds of sinful actions. And so if you'll notice what he does in verses 19 through 21, he lists 15 deeds of the flesh. This is what the flesh produces. The first 3 are sexual sins, immorality, impurity, sensuality. The next 2 are spiritual sins, idolatry and sorcery. And these were part of their pre-Christian experience, their pagan past. Then he lists 8 social sins. And then he finishes with 2 other sins, drunkenness and carousing, which were part of their pagan past. Now, I think in this context, what Paul is doing here is he's really emphasizing these 8 sins in the middle. I say that because, if you'll notice, really 2 reasons. The first is when you get to verses 22 and 23 in the fruit of the Spirit, there are 9 qualities that he described. They're all almost opposite of these 8 in the middle of this list. And when you get to the very end of the passage, verse 25 and 26, when he says, if we live by the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit. Let us not become boastful, challenging one another, envying one another. When he sums it all up, he's talking about those 8 sins that he lists in verses 19 through 21. These 8 sins are enmities, which are hostility and hatred, or strife, which is discord and antagonism, jealousy, which is ill will. It really comes from the term zealous. But it's a very, very strong on the negative side, and so it is selfishness that results in animosity or ill will. There are outbursts of anger, fits of rage. I talked to a staff member of a church one time, told me about his senior pastor who controlled his staff by fits of anger, fits of rage. And it got to be where they wouldn't cross him for anything. They wouldn't even offer anything that was different from what he was saying. Number five is the one that strikes me. It's disputes. Aristotle used it to talk about a person who was seeking an office, and so he created a problem because he wanted that office or position. Selfish ambition is another way of talking about this. I like what Dr. Constable says in his notes about this one. He uses the phrase, putting others down to get ahead. You ever seen that? You ever seen that among Christians and staff? I've been an associate pastor once, a church in the West Coast, and what he said to me, it was one of his opening statements was, he was talking about his church, he said, the major thing I'm concerned about is I really don't want to overshadow the senior pastor. And I don't know how that strikes you, but it strikes me as kind of an arrogant statement. And as I got to know more about that situation, what I found out was he was maneuvering with some of the elders in order to push the senior pastor out so that he could take that position. And that's the term that Paul is using here. There are dissensions and factions which refer to divisions. There's envying and jealousy. That's what the flesh produces. I know of a church in which a man and his wife who were part of the congregation, the pastor said something they didn't like. They got into a huff and they went through his past and they found something which really wasn't a problem, but they made it into a problem. And then what they did is they wrote a letter and they circulated that letter to the whole congregation and caused all kinds of splits and factions and divisions. Now, these social sins, of course, had been part of their pagan past. But what happened is that the flesh used the controversy of the law as a base of operations from which to launch these sins back into their experience. And every one of these terms has a spectrum of meanings, but they all describe some kind of self-centeredness that says, what's good for me is good for this church. It says, my view of this is obviously right, and everybody else needs to conform to that. Now, look, when you go into ministry, you are going to be exercising power. You have power. It's given to you sometimes by position. It's given to you by people who see you, respect you. You're a seminary graduate, all of that. And they will give you power, and you will exercise it. That's what leaders do. There isn't anything wrong with exercising power. What all leaders do. But James Means writes in a book, Leadership in Christian Ministry, he says, self-deception about one's behavior and motives is a potential hazard for all who are in positions of authority. A taste of power whets your appetite for it. Now, exercise of power can be legitimate or illegitimate. It's legitimate if it's used for the good of the people that you are leading. If it's used for the good of the ministry that you are one of the staff members of. It's illegitimate if you exercise power for your own benefit in a selfish sense. And what happens then is when you do that, when you exercise it in a selfish sense, you find that we have to justify it in some way. There's got to be some kind of justification for why I can do this, why I can move the senior pastor out so I can take this. And as we look for ways of justification, usually what we do, we end up making negative attributions about the other person. Because the other person is this way, so that justifies what I've done. And when you do that, what happens is you create a cycle that gets worse and worse. And it cycles out of control. And that's where they were in Galatia. Someone has said that when you exercise leadership, when you become a leader, you will either cast light or cast a shadow on those you lead. And so people are attacked and criticized. The associate pastor removed to get the senior pastor out of the way, justified by saying it, well, he's really not that good of a preacher. I'm a much better preacher. And he's not leading the church in the right direction, and I could do so much better for this church. Now, what Paul says finally is it's only as we live in the Spirit, live by the Spirit, that we can enjoy a safe and supportive community. He's talking in these passages from verse 16 on about the flesh and the spirit are at odds with each other. And the only way we can overcome the flesh is by walking in the Spirit. Now, he says in verse 24 that we crucified the flesh. Well, we did that when we trusted in Jesus Christ. But the problem is we have to keep doing that. Keep doing that. It uses the image of walking. When you think about walking, I love the image. It's a great image of walking in the Spirit, trusting in the Spirit. Because when you walk, that's a series of discrete steps. Now, you know, some of those steps are just easy. You just walk and it's not really a problem. But there are some steps that you have to pay more attention. When you're coming to a curb, you're going to step off a curb. Or when you're, you know, going up the stairs or something, you have to pay more attention. And I think what he's getting at here is when you sense, hopefully you have the ability to sense when the flesh is beginning to move you into some of these sins that he has just described. You have the sensitivity to say, I need to trust the Spirit right now in this situation because I'm going in the wrong direction. The flesh offers to pull you towards sin, and that's when you need to rely on the Holy Spirit. And so Paul then says, look, when you do that, the Spirit will produce its fruit in you. So rather than enmities and hostility and hatred, you'll have love and joy. And rather than strife and discord, peace. Rather than jealousy and ill will, patience. Rather than outbursts of anger and fits of rage, he says, acts of kindness. Disputes, putting down others in order to get ahead, says acts of goodness and generosity. Rather than dissensions and factions and divisions, faithfulness and reliability and trustworthiness. Rather than envying and jealousy, consideration and gentleness. And then there's the last one, self-control. One might think maybe that refers to the drunkenness and things like that, where that were at the end of the first list of sins. But maybe I think it would be better applied to that whole list of sins before. That self-control really becomes out of a sense of self-awareness so that you know, you sense when you are being pulled into that direction, and you have self-control so that at that point you can say, I need to trust in the Spirit. And the Spirit's power to get me past this particular situation. Now look, all of those qualities, both in the negative, the sins, and in these things that are the fruit of the Spirit, these are all things that are acted out in community. They're not internal personal values, the way he is portraying. These are actions, these are values, yes, but they are acted out in the way that you relate to others in the church, in the Christian community. And so that leads me to the question. What kind of atmosphere are you going to create when you lead in ministry? Are you going to cast light? Are you going to cast a shadow? Will people feel secure? So that they will feel free to exercise their gifts and so that together you can see the will of God accomplished, or they have to always watch their back. You know, when I first heard of these passages, my early Christian life, it was, as I said, a measure of spirituality. Maybe that's not so bad. But I'd change it in this, and here's the idea of the whole message. The measure of your spirituality is not the degrees you hold, the leadership positions you fill. The measure of your spirituality is how you treat fellow believers on your staff, in your church, in your ministry. That's the evidence of the fruit of the Spirit. Father, thank you for these men and women here who are going through this process at seminary. Thank you for the ministries that you have given them already and the ministries that you will take them into in the future. Thank you for the way that you will use them to give leadership to ministries all over this country and all over this world. And I pray, Father, that these men and women would be sensitive to the leading of your Spirit, so that the kind of ministry climate that they would create, the atmosphere that would be a result of their leadership, would be one of encouragement and helping people to be able to live out the gifts that God has given them and the ministries that he's called them to, that they wouldn't have to be looking over their shoulder or feeling insecure about where they stand, but that together they might, through love, serve one another so that the kingdom of Jesus Christ would be built up and so that they would truly know that we are your followers by the way that we love one another. Amen. You're dismissed.